For everyone who loves books, this is the audiobook show on RNIB Connect Radio.
Hello and welcome to the audiobook show recorded at the RNIB Talking Book Studios. I'm your host, Red Sale, and this week, Adair Depatan discusses wheelchair basketball, the London Paralympics, and his new book, Cyborg Cat and the Night Spider.
You've got to get the voices right, the delivery right, and I was like, oh my days, I've made this such hard work for myself, but it was fun.
Emma Hetherington blends cozy romance with harsh reality in her latest novel, Rewrite the Stars.
So will they or won't they make this happen? It's a love story that's gone over about 10 years.
And it started with a tweet. The Poet Laureate of Twitter, Brian Bilston, gives his reaction to being shortlisted for the Costa First Novel Award.
Probably all of this, from becoming popular on Twitter right through to the Costa nomination, has been something of a surprise to me because it feels altogether accidental, really.
That's all coming up in today's show. Adair Depatan is a wheelchair basketball star, TV presenter, disability rights campaigner, and author. He was recently at the RNIB Talking Book Studios, narrating the second book in his Cyborg Cat series for children. I so had to have a chat with him, and we ended up in a rather noisy cafe. So, you're back again, having just recorded Cyborg Cat and the Night Spider at the Talking Book Studios. How did you find narrating your own book?
It was intense. It was a lot more work than I thought it would be. I think I actually lost my voice towards the end of it. And it was quite complicated because I suddenly realised I'd written so many complicated bits and so much dialogue, and I thought, why didn't I write this in a lot more simpler form for me to like read out? I was kicking myself. And also there was a lot of humour in it. And with the jokes, you've got to get the timing right, you've got to get the voices right, the delivery right. And I was like, oh my days, I've made this such hard work for myself. But it was fun. It was 2 days of fun.
I was talking to your producer and he said he was having a really hard time keeping his hands on the controls because he was weeping with laughter.
Actually, when I was reading it, I was recording the voice, I was thinking, I don't remember putting so many jokes in it. And it was literally every two pages there was something, either comedy moment or some really joke, one-liner from Dexter. And you just got to have the delivery. I'm a writer, not a comedian, so it's slightly different.
Now, there's an awful lot of your own life in Cyborg Cat. Cyborg Cat is his nickname. His real name is the same as yours. You clearly had very happy, if slightly challenging, school days.
Yeah, I think for a lot of kids or a lot of people, you remember your school days quite vividly. And I guess mine was a little bit more eventful because I had so many different things or obstacles that I had to overcome. In terms of, I came over to the UK in the 70s, moved to East London. And UK is a very, very different world back then in terms of multiculturalism. There was only probably two other black kids in my school, maybe three or four Asian kids in the school. So I was different in that way. And then also the fact that I had a disability, I was the only kid with a disability. So I had all of those things to overcome. Well, not overcome immediately, but I stood out. And I had to deal with other kids' curiosity, other kids trying to understand, who's this strange guy? Why has he got this weird accent? And why does he walk in such a funny way? And also, why does his mum dress him up in such silly clothes on his first day of school? So, yeah, there was plenty of things that I had to deal with at a young age, yeah.
I know from your autobiographical essay that we've got in the Great Olympians book that's in the RNIB library that it was actually sport, it was playing football on your first day at school that really helped you integrate with the other kids. You might have been different to them, but you could sure as hell save a goal.
It's a true story. On my first day of school, turned up to school in a pink checkered flared suit with an afro and a frilly shirt and a bow tie, and obviously with my disability and my strange Nigerian accent, which was strange to the kids in East London, especially in the late 70s where they were not used to seeing people from other countries. And the first thing I wanted to do was join in with the other kids and play football. And I think they were still trying to get to grips or come to terms with how odd and different I looked, let alone try to understand how this strange-looking kid could play football. But I was convinced that I would be good in goal. You know, I'd played sport even from that young age. And when I managed to make this miraculous save from the best footballer in our school at the time, a guy called Stuart Harvey, it changed everything. I suppose for the kids, the last thing you expect when you see a kid with a disability, he's walking with a very obvious limp. I walked with calipers. I dressed really oddly. I looked like a geek. The last thing you'd expect is that that person would be great in goal and would be athletic and would be a sporting hero. But it happened to be, and it changed my life, really did.
And obviously you went into wheelchair basketball and represented Team GB at the 2000 Paralympics and actually played a very key part in bringing the Paralympics to London in 2012.
Yeah, well, I mean, sport has been an integral part of who I am ever since I was 7 or 8 years old. From the moment I made that save in goal, I kind of knew that sport was going to be the thing. It was going to be the vehicle that was going to change my life. And actually, Paralympic sport was new to me, and I didn't discover it till I was sort of 14 or 15, because in the 80s, it wasn't really talked about. I think a lot of people take it for granted since 2012 that Paralympic sport is big and we know who the Paralympians were. But for a young kid like myself, 11, 12 years old, growing up in East London, I'd never heard of disability sport. And it was just lucky that I was introduced to it by these physios. But once I got into it, it was just a perfect fit. It was my route to becoming an elite athlete, but it also, unbeknownst to me, I was going to open doors for the rest of my career, because it led to my TV career. And during the course of my TV career, it upped my profile. And that meant that Seb Coe, who was one of my heroes at the time, back in 2000, end of 2004, beginning of 2005, he headed up the bid team that was going for the London Paralympics. And he asked me if I would be an ambassador and be part of that team to try and bring the games to London. And I was blown away. I was flabbergasted, you know. I'm this kid from East London who, yeah, had these dreams of becoming a Paralympic athlete. And it's one thing going to the Paralympics, winning a medal and competing there, but to be then part of the team that was responsible to bring the games to the UK, and not only to the UK, but to my hometown, to Stratford, where I grew up, to the streets where I was being raced around in a shopping trolley. And I was going to be part of that change for the whole Paralympic movement. I think it's one of the most special and important moments in my life, yeah.
I must say, it certainly helped me accept my own disability, seeing the Paralympics in my own city and hearing the interviews that focused on the individual rather than the disability. And I think that's what's we've really seen change in our lifetime.
Yeah, you're totally right, Red. It's night and day in comparison to what the Paralympics was like in my time, and even disability awareness was like when I was a kid, and probably the same for yourself. Nobody spoke about the Paralympics, and people had a very negative, whether they admit it or not, perception of disability. It was all about, oh, let's hide them away, let's not talk about them. It was almost like people had a fear of being around people with disabilities. And even when the sport was covered and shown on the TV, no disrespect to the BBC, because I think they did what they could do in the early days, but the way they covered the sport was almost like it was an afterthought, and it wasn't about entertainment. It was almost like, it's a service, we've got to show this. And when it came to Channel 4, I was really lucky to be asked to be part of the team that could think up, how are we going to sell these games? How are we going to push these games in the UK? What can we do to make these games different to how they've been shown before? And I very much said, one of the things I really want is for us to get away from this idea of disabled people being a group of people that you feel sorry for and stop looking at these Paralympic athletes in this way, in this sort of like, oh, it's a recreation, or how nice is it for them to be able to get out and play some sport. I wanted people to look at them as athletes. And I said to the Channel 4 team that for us to know that we've succeeded with the Paralympics is that for us in 2013, if we could go out in the streets and we can ask a random person to name a Paralympic athlete, and if they can do that, then we know we've changed the game. And I think prior to 2012, most people would have known Tanny Gray Thompson's name. Some people would have known me as that guy on the BBC One Eyed In on TV. But apart from that, I don't think they would have been able to name anyone else. But 2013, Ellie Simmons was a household name. There was David Weir, Johnny Peacock, Hannah Cockcroft. All of these people suddenly became household names, and the perception of disability sport completely changed, and people stopped looking at the disability and they looked at them for what they are, great athletes.
And I think that's where it's also really important that you and your publisher, Bonnie Azaffa, who are very serious about making sure that disability becomes part of the mainstream literature that children are reading.
Totally agree with that. That was what attracted me to Bonnier. Initially, I was going to write an autobiography about my life, and they came from left field in terms of I sent them a chapter, and they were one of the few publishers to come back to me, and they said, we really like what you've written, but we think this would actually work even better as a children's book. And initially I was slightly insulted. I was thinking, well, is that the standard of my writing, that it's only good for 7 to 11 year olds and maybe even younger? But when they sat me down and they spoke to me and they talked about where children's literature was at this point in time, the fact that it lacked so much diversity, the fact that young boys were, they just weren't reading books and they weren't finding books that were that connected to them. It made me think of my childhood, and it made me think of what did I read when I was growing up? And I thought of all the classic children's novels and the children's books, and I thought, how many of them had disabled characters in them? And I couldn't think of any. And even when I could think of them, they were usually either villains or portrayed in a really negative way. And I also thought, how many of them had people of colour in them? None. And then that's when I suddenly realised somebody has to do this. But what I thought was even more important than writing this book that was representative of the children in British society, it was also making sure that it was entertaining, to make sure that this was a book that was fun and it educated, but it also had fun at the heart and friendship at the heart and a positive message. And I heard this term from a journalist, and I use it all the time because I think it's such a brilliant term. She says, there are window books and there are mirror books. And she says, window books are books which give you a perspective into someone's life. You look through the window into somebody else's life. And a mirror book is one that reflects your own life. And I wanted to try and write a book that did both that. It reflected the lives of people who never felt they had a voice, who never felt they could be seen out there. And it opened a window into the lives of the people that most people don't really hear about or know about. And I think it's so important because as a child, if you don't see yourself in a book, then you don't feel that you can take part in society. You don't feel like you're a part of society. And also to read a book where it says, not only can you be disabled and you can fit in with society and you can have friends, actually you can shine. You could be a superhero. You could be absolutely anything you want to be. And I hope it's just so important to get that message across in the book.
Cyborg Cat is a very cool cat, and I must say, I think it's a book that parents will enjoy reading with their kids. Adia Deputant, thank you so much for your time, and carry on the great work.
No, thank you. Thank you so much. And don't forget, all the first year's profits for Cyborg Cat and the Night Spider going to BBC Children in Need. So every copy you buy will go towards helping children who really need it all over the UK. This was the perfect opportunity for a wind-up. I am an expert, in fact, I said, holding my head up high and trying to look as expertly expert as I could. My village in Nigeria was always full of animals. There were two-headed emus and giant spotted flying camels all over the place. They were practically my pets. By the time I'd finished describing these mystical beasts, I was in full David Attenborough mode. Dexter's eyes were as big as snooker balls, and his mouth had opened so wide in amazement at the thought of these incredible animals that I'm sure I caught a glimpse of the gooey wagon wheel he'd scoffed for lunch. I desperately tried to keep a straight face as I carried on. Oh, and my personal favourite are the bum bum bees. They're half bee and half bottom. They feed exclusively on baked beans. You always know when they're near because of the terrible stench and the sound. Bum bum bees, Dexter said quizzically. What sound do they make? I leant over in his direction and pursed my lips together and... I blew a large raspberry in his ear. They're basically like a swarm of giant flying farts, I said, when I was all raspberried out. Just a whiff of their odour is enough to kill a fully grown human. Brian and Melody obviously weren't fooled, and Shed shook his head with amusement. But Dexter bought it hook, line and sinker. Two-headed emus, giant spotted flying camels and bum-bum bees. I can't wait to see them, he shouted. Brian and Shed fell about laughing. Even Melody was giggling. What? What is it? Dext, I said, if you ever see a bum-bum bee or a giant flying camel, I'm taking you straight to the doctor. Dexter looked cross when he realised I'd been teasing him. Yeah, well, what if I see a night spider, he said defiantly. That really wasn't what I'd expected him to say. Dexter was pointing to a wall with the coolest graffiti I'd ever seen. We all looked up at it. There was a splash of colourful zigzags interspersed with googly eyes and sparkly diamonds. At the bottom, the artist had signed it Night Spider. The N and the S were much bigger and brighter than the other letters, so they really stood out. Wow, cool, said Melody. Amazing, I agreed. I wonder who this night spider is.
Ade Adepatan narrating Cyborg Cat and the Night Spider. Cyborg Cat and the Night Spider is out now and should be in the RNIB library soon, where it will join the first book in the series, The Rise of the Parsons Road Gang. And if you'd like to hear more about Ade's life in his own words, then why not download Amazing Olympians from the RNIB library? It's TB704733. You're listening to RNIB Connect Radio's one-stop shop for book news, reviews and author interviews. Coming up later, he's been hailed as Adrian Mole for the 21st century. Brian Bilston reveals what inspired his satirical Diary of a Somebody. But first, Emma Hetherington is an international bestseller. In novels such as The Legacy of Lucy Hart and A Piece of Me and You, she's blended feel-good romance with the tragic fragility of human life. Her road to success has had its own bumps, as we discussed when she joined me from her home in County Tyrone. I began by asking her to tell me about her new novel, Rewrite the Stars.
Rewrite the Stars is my brand new novel. It's just out now. It's set in Dublin and it's a perfect winter warmer, I'm told. It tells the story of a girl called Charlotte Taylor, who is a budding songwriter, and one day she meets the drummer in her brother's new band when she's quite young, and there's an instant attraction between the two of them. His name's Tom Farley. And he's very, very handsome, very charismatic, and they have a spark that just can't be denied the moment they meet. But fate isn't ready to let them be together because he already has a girlfriend, so they have to walk away. And then 5 years later, their paths cross again, and it's a will they or won't they make this happen. It's a love story that goes on over about 10 years. Music is a very, very big theme in the story. But he is a songwriter. She's working on it. She's got a day job as a primary school teacher when we next meet her. But it's been described like Sliding Doors meets One Day, and the latest comparison was to P.S. I Love You, Cecilia Ahern's book, which was a great, great, great seal of approval for me to have compared to that book. So far so good. It's getting some lovely reviews and it's really exciting.
It's set in the build-up to Christmas, so it's a perfect Christmas read.
That's right. When we see Tom and Charlotte meet 5 years after their first meeting, they've just broken up for Christmas holidays, so it's a very wintry night, and she was outside for a bit of fresh air when she's in a pub. She's just finished up school, she's primary school teacher, when she goes outside, and she can't believe it when sitting outside. In the smoking area, actually, is this guy who she first encountered 5 years before. So it's a second chance of their love, I suppose, happening. But as I say, they're in for a bumpy ride. The story starts at Christmas, but it goes on over the next 5 or 6 years of their life. So it's not a book that you just have to read at Christmas, but I think it will really get you in the mood for the festive season if you picked it up now this time of year.
And as you say, music is absolutely central to the plot. Charlie is a budding country and western singer, isn't she? She writes her own songs.
She is, yes. I think a part of that probably comes from some of my own dreams. You know, I always had a great love for American country music in particular, and as you probably know, Ireland is a great place for country music as well. So this book is a bit special because there's a scene, without giving too much away, in which Tom Farley sings a song that he wrote for her. And initially I was going to write the lyrics of this song myself, and then I thought, you know what, wouldn't it be a great idea if it was an actual real song that readers could then listen to after they've read the book? So I kind of put my neck on the line a bit, and I contacted a singer-songwriter from Belfast called Gareth Dunlop, who has written for the TV series Nashville, who I'm sure some of your listeners will be aware of. It was a great, great TV series that ran for 6 or 7 years there from America. And it tells the story of behind the scenes of Nashville and the country music scenes. And he's also written for a lot of movies. So I was aiming quite high when I contacted him, and to my delight, he agreed to come on board, and he has written the most beautiful song to go along with the book. If your listeners are fans of country music at all, they might enjoy listening to Gareth Dunlop's music, and the song in particular is called You. It's a beautiful song. I'm really, really delighted to have him on board, which gives that little edge, I think, to other books that are out there at the minute.
Now, I haven't got that far in the audiobook version that I'm listening to yet. Don't give me any spoilers, but is there a clip of the song in the audiobook as well?
Yes, you're in for such a treat, because that was one of the lovely things that Gareth and his management in Nashville agreed to, that we could actually use a clip of the song in the audiobook. I think the whole song is in there somewhere. It's just maybe broken up to allow the story to be told in between the verses, but yes, I don't want to ruin the story for you because it is such a poignant part, but yes, you will hear it if you're listening to it in audio.
Fantastic. Well, I look forward to that. You're certainly keeping me guessing as though will they, won't they. I'm not sure which side I want her to come down on.
Well, I think that's a good thing that you're not sure, because even as a writer, you know, when I was writing the story, I wasn't too sure if I was Team Tom or Team Jack, who of course is the other love interest that comes into her life. And I enjoyed the whole mystery as I was writing it as to which way she was going to go. And so far, everyone who has read the book has come back to me and said, yes, she made the right decision, apart from one person who said no. So I'm really glad that there was one person who disagreed with me, because it's great to have a bit of contrast and colour. It was just in a review, somebody said, oh no, she didn't make the right decision. But everybody else who read it said, yes, she did. So it'll be interesting to see what you think.
Well, I was going to ask, did you actually make up your mind which way she was going to jump at the end of the book? Or did you keep yourself guessing?
I had no idea which way she was going to go. Now, initially, when I put together the plot of the story or when I'm planning a book, I like to have a kind of rough idea as to where it's going to go, expecting that by the time I get to that stage that it may have changed a little bit. But this time round, I really was torn myself. I kept on thinking, it's nearly like, does she follow her heart or does she follow her head? Or does she have this big moment of realisation that let the penny drop? And I suppose I was waiting on that moment myself, writing as her character. I was waiting for that penny to drop and the moment of realisation so that it becomes very clear to her. So it's not just a wishy-washy decision that she just decides to throw in at the end, and that it is something that actually starts to make sense. So it did happen as the story unfolded this time, which was really, really interesting. And it kept me on my toes, you know, while I was writing it as well, because I got caught up in her emotion and in her thoughts and feelings, and I was really following her way of approaching it rather than maybe my own.
And there's nothing predictable about your books. What I like about your writing is that, yeah, they're feel-good romance, but actually you bring in the fragility of human life. They're, I don't want to say gritty because they're not violent or anything, but actually there are elements to all your books that are not afraid of confronting the unpleasant things that happen in our lives. And that's clearly something that you feel very strongly about and that's actually been part of your own life.
Yeah, well, I think no matter how much an author tries to say, oh, no, there's nothing of me in my stories and there's nothing of me in my books, it's all fiction, it's all made up. Somewhere along the line, if it's good writing, you will know that the author has maybe lived some experiences to make the story convincing. And including this one, my last four books, I have deliberately tried to face some very challenging subjects. So The Legacy of Lucy Hart dealt with organ donation. A Part of Me and You dealt with bereavement and motherhood. And then American Hope Street, which is last year's novel, it dealt with loneliness, not just loneliness in the elderly, which is maybe the first thing you might think of, but loneliness in young people as well, from all sorts of walks of life. So I like to explore real life issues. And I also aim to create books that aren't just forgettable the minute you close the last page. I don't want readers to say, oh yes, that was lovely, and put it away and never think about it again. I want them to think, gosh, I can relate to that part of that character's story, or I can learn something from them. I've deliberately tried to put life-affirming messages into each of those books, and that's the response that I'm getting, thankfully, is that people are thinking about them for a while. They're talking about the stories with their friends. They're recommending other people to read them, maybe who they think can get something from them as well. And it just makes them think about their own life. The messages I get from readers are phenomenal along those lines, especially, I suppose, the organ donation thing from Lucy Hart. So many people got in touch to say that it had changed their views either on organ donation as a subject or that it even made them understand better how to deal with a loved one whose organs have been donated. And it also urged a lot of people to go and sign on the register for organ donation. So when you hear things back like that, you can't get any bigger compliment. So hopefully, again, with this book, some people have said, you know, it touches upon even mental health issues and some of the deeper parts of our mind that we try and pretend everything's fine in life sometimes when behind the scenes we're living a completely different experience. So hopefully it gives people a good discussion topic and it either helps them maybe get through a certain part of their own life or help someone that, they might know.
Well, as we come up to Christmas, I think the greatest gift anybody can give is a second chance at life, and we should all sign up for organ donation. And I know you lost your own mother to a heart attack when you were very young.
Yes, that's right, very suddenly. And I often too think of how, if that had happened, maybe nowadays medical knowledge and everything is so different. She died in 1991, and even the doctor who was out with her that morning was absolutely stunned to the core. I believe he had to take some time off work to get his own head around, but you know, if he could have done anything different. But she died suddenly from a heart attack at the age of 36, and it just obviously devastated all of our lives. There were six of us at home, and she was buried on Daddy's 41st birthday. So he was left with six kids, and absolutely devastated. And even 28 years on, you know, we've all grown up now, and we've all got our own partners and our own children, and now even watching him at home on his own, the pain really never goes away of that. And a lot of that experience that I've carried through my life helps when it comes to writing stories with emotional depth, because even though I mightn't have experienced everything the character's going through, I can always dig deep into those emotions from within myself and really get the heart and soul of a character's feelings onto the page. And so definitely something like that had such a big effect in my life that it never really, really ever goes away.
Now, you mentioned that your mum yourself, I believe you got five kids, four teenagers and a little one. Where do you find the time to write?
They're all at school now. In fact, one has graduated from university, Jordan, the eldest girl. She's 23 now. And then Jade has just started university. The boys are doing A-levels. And then the wee man, Sonny, it's actually his fifth birthday today. He's just started primary one. So I don't actually know myself now. I've got a full day.
Oh, well, you just have to write even more books then.
I know. And you know what? It just makes such a difference, because when you've kids at home or even during the summer holidays, my whole day is taken up with either being a taxi driver, a cook, cleaner, all the stuff that comes with parenthood. And just to have those few hours now during the day, it's a luxury. And I absolutely am making it work through my writing. I can see it, just having that extra time. So before that, I would have probably written mostly at night.
Because you wrote six books in 5 years when you had pretty young kid.
It's a bit mixed, looking back, I don't know how it happened, but yes, I've written the four novels that we've been discussing, and I've also ghostwritten two autobiographies, one for the country music singer Philomena Begley, and another one for Nathan Carter, who's originally from Liverpool. He's a big star here in Ireland. So I squeezed those two in along the way. But I suppose it's like anything, if you enjoy what you're doing, this is a job for me now. It's a bit like asking any working mother, how do you do your job? Well, I didn't have to get any childcare with Sonny over the past 5 years. I've just kept him at home with me, and I suppose I've just walked around his wee day. You know, if he's having a nap, I'll do more. Peppa Pig was a great babysitter, I have to say. I just made it happen, yeah. And if you love doing something enough, you will make it happen. Like, I wouldn't be sitting watching TV myself at all, and I would have to give up things like that, that are turned down a few social events, but nothing too crazy. I did manage to have a good social life along the way too, and family life. But it's just to say, it's something I love, and it's now a job, and I'm absolutely delighted to be doing it as a job.
And writers need to read. So did you find yourself listening to audiobooks yourself?
Well, I haven't as much time as I would love to have to read now, but I still do totally agree with you that writers do need to read. So what I do now is, when I've finished the first draft of a book and I send it off to my editor, it takes her a few weeks to come back with her suggestions, and I have a window of a few weeks, and that's whenever I treat myself to a couple of good novels that I've been itching to read, watching them social media and stuff and seeing them in the bookshelves. I'll wait until I've got that gap, and then I'll read a couple of books while I'm waiting for her to come back to me. And I think that's great exercise for the mind as well, and it's such a treat to relax with a good book. So I still do find that time, but it's just more structured, I suppose. It's not as every day as it used to be.
And you must be delighted that your own books are reaching an audience of people who are print disabled through the audiobook versions. Have you had much to do with choosing the narrators yourself?
With this one, yes. Now, the previous few books, they were recorded, and I'd always be sent the voices to approve, but I would always be able to give my approval on that. And then with Rewrite the Stars, I was invited over to London to sit in on the audio recording. Now, unfortunately, just due to family commitments, I couldn't make that, but I was given snippets to hear and was absolutely delighted with their choice of actors. So I've listened to bits of it, and I think the most exciting thing, of course, is that there's a song in this book. So not only can audiobook listeners hear the story, but they're also going to be treated to a very, very lovely song as well.
It's always nice to get something that the print readers are not getting.
Yeah, so. Exactly. And that is a complete bonus with the audio version, because anyone reading it in paperback or in ebook format will obviously have to go and either download a song or look it up online somewhere, whereas audio listeners have got it straight away. They don't have to do that. It's part of the story.
I'm very much looking forward to getting to that part of the book. Do you have any links to Sightloss yourself?
Well, my brother, when he was 16, he had a brain hemorrhage, and we almost lost him. And we were told that it probably would never happen him again, and that, especially an aneurysm, and that he didn't need any treatment. He was just able to then try and get back to life as usual and go back to school. 1 year later, it happened him again. The doctors were completely flummoxed, but this time he did have to go to Sheffield and he had surgery. Now, one of the side effects of his illness is that he has lost his sight in one eye, and he's going to be 40 next year. And he was just telling me the other day that his sight in his good eye, as he calls it, is starting to really go. So he's under investigation really for that. It's something probably we have ahead of us to face as a family.
At least he's going to be able to carry on accessing your books and those of other authors.
Exactly. It's a great way to relax, to listen to an audiobook. And of course, it's portable as well. You can listen to it in the car, you can listen to it in the train, and on any journey. So it's something that I'm really, really going to get into myself, because for someone who's busy as well, and is always on the move with teenagers and kids, it will probably make my reading library shoot through the roof whenever I take up audiobooks more. I'm looking forward to that.
I can do the cooking and the ironing at the same time.
Absolutely.
As listening to an audiobook. Can't do that with a paperback in your hand.
No, definitely not.
Emma Hetherington, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
I was 22 years and 9 months old when I first fell in love with Tom Farley. Elbow deep in a sink full of suds in our student kitchen, I watched him come in through the back door with my brother Matthew, steal my heart on his way past with his old school movie star type swagger, and I knew my life was never going to be the same again. My mother used to joke about how I was born cynical, and I was definitely way too sceptical to believe in love at first sight, but this person's very presence hit me like a bolt of lightning. He turned my head like no other man had done before, and like none would ever do again. Tom Farley, with his megawatt smile, tousled brown hair, dark stubble on a chiseled jawline, the cheekiest dimples you ever did see, and bold, devilish eyes of turquoise green, made me weak at the knees.
Avena Wallis narrating Rewrite the Stars by my guest Emma Hetherington. Rewrite the Stars is TB 704767. For information on other books of hers in the RNIB library, search rniblibrary.com or call the helpline on 0303 123 9999. That number again, 0303 123 9999. Brian Bilston has built his reputation as a poet via Twitter. Now his debut novel, Diary of a Somebody, has been shortlisted for the Costa First Novel Award. Like the journals of Adrian Mole and Charles Pooter, it takes a tongue-in-cheek view of contemporary life. And in Brian Bilston's case, that means social media. He came to the studio to tell me more, and I began by asking him how he felt about being dubbed the unofficial poet laureate of Twitter.
It wasn't a term that I coined myself and probably wouldn't have chosen it for myself either, not least because, you know, there are plenty of other people out there on Twitter writing and sharing their poetry, you know, some of it very wonderful, some of it perhaps less so. It's very flattering to have that label at the same time, although I started writing on Twitter, you know, I have kind of gone beyond that medium now, so maybe it won't be with me forever, that tag.
Do you think that social media lends itself particularly well to short-form poetry?
Yes, I do. I mean, I think partly the limitations of the medium itself means that the kinds of things that you're able to write are already kind of self-governed in that way. But also, I think in terms of how people consume stuff nowadays, you know, there's lots of media reports about attention spans and all of that business. So actually having that kind of place where you can write something that's kind of short and hopefully powerful in some kind of way, also in a medium where you're kind of getting all the rest of your kind of feed of information from, I think is quite a powerful thing for poetry.
Did you find the discipline of 128 characters or whatever quite useful to boil your poetry down from maybe a longer first draft?
Yes, no, absolutely. And when I first got going, you know, it wasn't easy. I think it did kind of help me as a writer. You know, there's that line from Churchill, isn't there, when he kind of apologises for having written such a long letter to somebody because he didn't have time to write a short one. And I think that's probably quite true for something like Twitter. Although I do sort of cheat as well, in that I have been known to write longer poems and then I simply take a photograph of them and stick them up on the platform.
Uh-huh. What I'm very struck by is the day-to-day nature of the poems that you and other Twitter poets write, which are far more relevant to my life and that of other readers than perhaps the more literary poets.
Yep.
And I wonder if that's been part of the reason why poetry has found a new life over the past 5 or 10 years.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of truth in that. One of my own experiences of writing on Twitter is that not only is it a good medium to relate ideas that are relevant, but also it's a great source of ideas too. You know, so when I've kind of gone on and taken a look, kind of see what's happening in the world, you see the, you know, you have a feed of what's happening in, you know, in the political world, for instance, or, you know, you see the hashtag Penguin Awareness Day trending or whatever it would be, and it's a sort of endless source of ideas and inspiration for a writer, because, you know, particularly writing poetry, there's a danger if you just sit at your desk and stare out of the window, you just end up writing 50 different poems about the tree that's situated outside your house.
The Diary of a Somebody has grown out of your success on Twitter, and it displays all the best things about you, your playfulness, your love of rewriting other people's songs with new lyrics, and rewriting some of the classics. Were you like
your character in The Diary of a Somebody, always a secret novelist hoping to get out?
I suppose I was. I mean, I think probably more than that. I was a secret writer. You know, I was writing poetry for many years before I ever shared anything with anyone. It was only when I started sort of engaging in social media that I ever had the courage to share my words with anyone. I think, you know, for a long time I'd nursed sort of ambitions about writing, but never really done anything concrete about it. And I think the poetry via Twitter gave me confidence in my own voice. And all the same, the step then to writing a novel for me was quite a big one. And I think the format of the diary kind of helped in that respect, in that, you know, writing a series of daily entries had a kind of familiarity to it in a way that, you know, writing a discrete poem, you know, which was something I'd obviously got used to, that kind of helped me with the actual writing of the novel. Because I think if I'd just simply thought, right, so I'm going to start this novel today and it's going to have, you know, 16 chapters and it's going to be 300 pages and I need a plot and all of this, I would be so daunted probably that I wouldn't really get going.
I think we're roughly the same age, and I was wondering if perhaps The Diary of Adrian Mole had been a big influence on you as well.
It absolutely has. I think I was probably roughly the same age as Adrian Mole when his first diary came out, you know, when he was 13 and three quarters. And I absolutely loved that book then. It must be said, I didn't completely forget about that book. It was a long time before I went back to that book. And I think it was a few years ago when there was, I think, an anniversary. Or maybe it was Adrian Mole's kind of fictional 50th birthday. There's quite a lot in the newspapers, and I suddenly realised what a wonderful book that was, and that really helped me. That had a direct impact on me thinking about the idea for this novel, and thinking about that structure, and thinking about the tone and the humour, and of course, you know, the way that Adrian Mole himself kind of writes poetry, not always to great success, but always in a kind of hugely kind of funny and entertaining way.
And I think for many of us, Adrian Mole was quite educational. I was struck when I was reading your book that it actually is rather a good educational tool. It teaches children the different forms of poetry that you can approach, sonnets, Clara Hughes, haiku, and so on and so forth. And it also teaches that failure can be part of success eventually. Have you been asked into many schools to talk about the book?
I do have the invitation to go to schools. I mean, and really until this year, I wasn't really doing any public appearances, mainly because my profile on social media was a kind of rather kind of dark and shadowy one. So I kind of lurked behind a kind of avatar and didn't really emerge from there very much.
The banks going of Twitter, out with, I think you've been called, haven't you?
Yes, exactly. And going out and promoting the book has meant that I've now had to meet members of the public face to face. But it was, you know, it was partly because of, you know, how my kind of presence emerged on Twitter, but also, like the Brian of the diary, I'm not a very kind of public person in that way, and the idea of standing up in front of people and reading poems is one that generally kind of fills me with horror, and possibly fills my audience with horror too. Who knows?
Well, I hear your appearance at Wigtown, which I narrowly missed, was very, very successful. Did you enjoy it?
I did enjoy it, and I'm being slightly tongue in cheek with how I talk about performances, but I always have this thing where I dread the prospect of it. And then as soon as I'm up there and talking to people and reading some poems, I really start to enjoy myself. So the reality of it is far better than the prospect of it.
Now, I came to the book slightly nervous as a blind person because I'd heard that you like to play with form and structure. So there are pyramid-shaped poems and Venn diagram poems. And yet you really lucked out with your narrator, Ben Miller. He somehow managed to convey the sort of the visual aspect of a lot of those poems brilliantly, so yep. I didn't feel I'd missed out at all. Did you have a hand in choosing him?
I didn't, but I was delighted to hear that he was going to do the audio version, and I did go along to one of the recording sessions, and I went along in a rather kind of guilty fashion because I kind of turned up there and saw Ben and the producer looking slightly stressed by some of the, you know, the poems that I had them deal with. There are maybe two or three poems that I don't think made it onto the audio version because they were simply just too too difficult to replicate audibly, I guess, some of the, you know, the impact that they'd have on the page. But there are also other things there which I'm sure that he probably wouldn't have thanked me for at the time. So, you know, particularly those kind of rewritten songs. So, you know, the joy of hearing Ben Miller trying to recreate Kate Bush's Wuthering Heights, for instance, is probably something that he'll never forgive me for.
My resolution will be diarised. I shall write a poem a day. It will be a daily testament to the power of poetry and how it can help us make sense of the world, a kind of inky monument to truth and beauty. I shall set my poems down here, in this surprisingly affordable medium-ruled notebook with acid-free pages, rounded corners, and an expandable inner pocket, with its cover illustration of an anthropomorphized white Japanese bobtail cat sporting a red bow. I do not underestimate the task ahead. Writing a poem every day will not be easy. It will require discipline, mental resilience, self-sacrifice, vast reservoirs of imagination, and a ready supply of custard creams. Tuesday, January the 2nd. I lay in bed until midday, bathing in the cotton sea of tranquility that is my duvet. Inspired by my surroundings, I attempted a poem. I got as far as, "Duvet, you are so groovy. I'd like to stay under you all of Tuesday." I didn't care for it much. The rhymes seemed a little forced. I worked on it for a while longer, but produced nothing more of note except for a doodle of a cat on a skateboard. I was quite pleased with that. The cat was wearing headphones, and I'd drawn a speech bubble coming out of its mouth with the words, "I am a cat on a skateboard," written inside it. I am 45 years old.
Ben Miller, narrating Diary of a Somebody, written by my guest, Brian Bilston.
It's a very, very funny book, and clearly has tickled the Costa Award judges. Were you surprised to find yourself on the shortlist?
Utterly surprised, yes. Probably all of this, from becoming popular on Twitter right through to the Costa nomination, has been something of a surprise to me, because it feels altogether accidental, really. I didn't really set out with any long-term plan of building a career as a writer, and so the Costa Award came out of the blue, and you know, I kind of felt like there must have been some sort of mix-up, maybe that Bill Bryson had written a novel or something, that they'd just simply got letters muddled up.
Now, anybody who's read the book will know that you have a problem with bins. Is this something that you're working through?
Yes, the bins. Well, I did have a problem with bins. Now I have alerts on my phone, which help. But they do feature, I think it's the relentless regularity of the bins that means that they're never far from my mind. Actually, bin day is tomorrow morning, so a bit later today I'll be sorting out the recycling.
Well, is it recycling or is it landfill?
It's a recycling day tomorrow. And my phone alert tells me that, which is kind of very helpful. But, you know, I have been that man running down the street in his carpet slippers pursuing the rubbish truck.
Haven't we all? And I think that is the beauty and the appeal of Diary of Somebody. And I hope many more people will enjoy reading it.
Thank you.
And be turned on to poetry. I think my final question is, who was the poet who turned you on to poetry?
I think it goes back to Philip Larkin and studying him for A-level. And I think up until that point I hadn't really been interested in poetry. I didn't think really had anything in it for me. And then for a teenager growing up in the 1980s, there was something about Larkin, his combination, I think, of bleakness and humour, and swearing, probably, that really kind of appealed to me. And, you know, from there, I kind of discovered, and I guess, sort of more out-and-out comic poets, like Roger McGough, who's also a big influence.
And Brian, I like to finish my interviews by asking my guests to nominate the books of their life. So could I ask you whether there was a book that you read as a child or a young man that made you dream of becoming a writer?
I'd probably have to say The Secret Diary of Adrian Mole, age 13 and three quarters. That book's always stayed with me partly because of its humour, but also the character of Adrian Mole, somebody who has aspirations to greatness and often falls short, but is still kind of heroic in the striving towards those aspirations. So that's a favourite of my childhood.
My mother has just come into my room and said she had something awful to tell me. I sat up in bed and put a dead serious expression on my face just in case she'd got 6 months to live, or she'd been caught shoplifting or something. She fiddled with the curtains, dropped cigarette ash all over my Concorde model, and started mumbling on about adult relationships and life being complicated and how she must find herself. She said she was fond of me. Fond! And would hate to hurt me. And then she said that for some women, marriage was like being in prison. Then she went out. Marriage is nothing like being in prison. Women are let out every day to go to the shops and stuff, and quite a lot go to work. I think my mother is being a bit melodramatic. Finished Animal Farm. It is dead symbolic. I cried when Boxer was taken to the vets. From now on, I shall treat pigs with the contempt they deserve. I am boycotting pork of all kinds. Tuesday, March the 3rd. Shrove Tuesday. I gave Barry Kent his protection money today. I don't see how there can be a God. If there was, surely he wouldn't let people like Barry Kent walk about menacing intellectuals. Why are bigger youths unpleasant to smaller youths? Perhaps their brains are easily worn out with all the extra work they have to do, making bigger bones and stuff. Or it could be that the big youths have got brain damage because of all the sport they play. Or perhaps big youths just like menacing and fighting. When I go to university, I may study the problem. I will have my thesis published, and I will send a copy to Barry Kent. Perhaps by then he will have learnt to read. My mother had forgotten that today was Pancake Day. I reminded her at 11 p.m. I'm sure she burnt them deliberately. I will be 14 in 1 month's time.
The Secret Diary of Adrian Mole, aged 13 and three quarters, by Sue Townsend, is TB4751, and it's narrated by Gretel Davis.
And is there a book that on a rainy day you'd like to curl up with and reread?
I'm a really big fan of Flann O'Brien, in particular his book The Third Policeman, another influence on me. I can't think how many times I've read that book, but there's something quite joyful about that book in particular. You know, it's funny. There's also a kind of level of kind of sinister about it as well. And it's just got this wonderful structure. The end of the book takes you back to the beginning of the book, which I think is just so clever.
I can recall in every detail the evening I walked back into my own house with a travelling bag in each hand. I was 20 years of age. It was an evening in a happy yellow summer, and the door of the public house was open. Behind the counter was John Divney, leaning forward on the low-down porter dashboard with his fork, his arms neatly folded and his face looking down on a newspaper which was spread upon the counter. He had brown hair and was made handsomely enough in a small, butty way. His shoulders were broadened out with work, and his arms were thick like little tree trunks. He had a quiet, civil face, with eyes like cow's eyes, brooding, brown and patient. When he knew that somebody had come in, he did not stop his reading, but his left hand strayed out and found a rag and began to give the counter slow, damp swipes. Then, still reading, he moved his hands one above the other, as if he was drawing out a concertina to full length, and said, "A schooner?"
The Third Policeman by Flann O'Brien is TB5886. Narrated by Dennis Hawthorne.
And finally, is there a book that you've read recently that you'd like to share with the Read On listeners?
Yes, a couple of months ago I read Leonard and Hungry Paul by Ronan Hessian. It's such a delightful book. Again, it's a novel that uses humour to good effect. This sort of wonderfully gentle and kind book about love and relationships and families. And it's just, you know, it made me smile from the very first line pretty much through to the end of it. And, you know, I'd really recommend that to anyone.
After dinner, each evening, he would sit on the couch in that customary way of single men, for whom time is something to fill rather than spend. He would open one of the historical biographies waiting patiently on his bookcase, several of which had bookmarks just a few pages in, the subjects yet to get beyond their childhood. He found bookshops to be comforting places, and book buying a comforting activity. But he was an absent-minded reader these days, the act of reading that much more solitary without his mother pottering around the house in the background. He would sit at the table and try to copy sketches from A Birdwatcher's Year, a sandling scuttling along the shore, or a guillemot with its eggs shaped like a pear to stop them from rolling off cliffs. But with nobody to show the sketches to, he became careless about the details on the feathers and the subtlety of the colours. And of course, there was always the TV, supreme among alternatives, though strangely distant when there is no longer someone else on the couch to talk about it with. Had Leonard been a different type of person, he might have gone to the pub to meet some friends for an evening of darts, dominoes, cards, or other prison games, but nothing made him feel lonelier these days than the thought of spending time in the company of extroverts. It is at times like this that we find out who our true friends are, or, in Leonard's case, we call upon our only friend. And so, to avoid or fill that stale chapter of the evening, Leonard had made it a habit to take refuge in the company of Hungry Paul.
Leonard and Hungry Paul by Ronan Hessian is available commercially wherever you buy your audiobooks, and it's narrated by John Hopkins.
Brian Bilston, thank you so much for sharing your obvious joy of reading, and best of luck with the Costa Prize.
Thank you so much.
Diary of a Somebody is out now commercially wherever you buy your audiobooks. Alas, that's all we've got time for this week. The audiobook show will be back at the same time next week. But if you can't wait that long, why not subscribe to our podcast? All our past shows are there, packed with book news, reviews, and exclusive author interviews. It's free, and you'll find a link on the front page of our website, rnibconnectradio.org.uk. You can also follow us on Twitter. I'm at RedSale, and producer Robert is at talking_books. Farewell until next week from the RNIB Talking Book Studios.